Following up on a leftover promise from the feedback memo era, I am willing, able, and ready to do a text review session where we simply have kind of a question and answer sort of thing outside the normal structure of the class. I'm totally willing to do that. We've done it in the past years, and it's been quite fun. Maybe fun, whatever, but it's been useful. Can I just get a sense, either by thumb or by hand, as to how many people would find it useful to have such a session in the format I described? Okay, that is consensus of both kinds. I nominate the day of Thursday, November 16th in the afternoon. Is Thursday, November 16th in the afternoon? For whom is that good? That's Ames. That's Ames. Yes, does Ames just start at dinner time? Some of you were in Ames or something?
No, just.
I mean, yeah,
it's only so many things in one day.
I see. If you're going to Ames tonight, you could possibly come for a reception. I don't know. We could do it like at 4 o'clock or something, or earlier. Earlier is better. 2 o'clock? All right. So we will aim towards 2 o'clock on Thursday, November 16th. It turns out that if we want to do it before Thanksgiving, there just aren't a whole lot of other times. But I'll give a final announcement, and if you feel very strongly about it, as your wife, you're probably writing me an email right now, and I'll mention it later, and again, try to work on time. I will try some cute technical way to determine the best time, but it'll be a failure. Okay, so yesterday was a pretty interesting class by my lights, although I must say the class seemed somewhat laconic. It's the first time we actually worked hustling towards the finish because of the pending deadline, rather, it was the Mediterranean food begging us. So it might have just been that it's a quiet week, or it might have been something more on the class. But today I'm hoping we will spruce things and spice things up a little bit. But just in case you can't, I'm planning to lecture a little bit so as to take people off the hook. Also, I'd say there's no panel for today. So in essence, we are all on panel. That's my few things. Times that I may seek without voting a cultural engine some input from the rest of us here. Apparently, we tested the lights and they work better today than they did yesterday. All right, so I'm going to talk about the Microsoft case. By the time you leave class today, I can't case because I'll be blinded. By the time you leave class today, I'm hoping you will have a sense of the Microsoft case, both kind of the ups and downs of it, what actually has happened in it, and maybe even why it matters, why you should. I mean, even with a level of detail that even if you don't care, you can at least understand the case and appreciate it for the sort of grim beauty it represents in our modern American legal system and the anti-trust law with it. But before we do it, I'm hoping, the mouse is working, just to talk a little about where we are. We're sort of making transitions, as I said. So here's where we are, recapitulation without the pretty pictures of sort of the theory of the courts. Step one, I say, is there exists, that's the backwards E, there exists a status quo of some kind. Call it law without the internet. So there's some status quo, and there's conflict within it, and blah, 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 you have the way things are. Then you have, in some ways, the technology seriously upsetting the status quo. And you can fill in any of the particular case studies that we've done surrounding privacy, property, and speech to think of examples of the technology seriously undermining the status quo. Maybe one running example, just to keep it concrete, would be this ongoing case that we mentioned before about Yahoo in France, in which it may be illegal to trade votes in the United States. In France, it is legal to trade Nazi memorabilia. And Yahoo has auctions that are meant to be like eBay auctions, except they're far less popular. But one of the things that gets traded on Yahoo auctions is Nazi memorabilia. A crested dagger from 1941 with a particular seal on it, that kind of thing. Somebody puts it up for sale on Yahoo, and the French get unhappy. The first way in which they got unhappy was that it was Yahoo.fr. It was actually the French version of Yahoo. And Yahoo said, okay, just to indulge you, the French, we're going to keep an eye on the auctions. And we see something for Nazi memorabilia, we'll take it off. And the French said, but that's not good enough, because there's nothing to stop somebody in France from typing yahoo.com instead of yahoo.fr and getting to the sort of .com auctions you have, and we want you to stop allowing Nazi memorabilia there as well. Thus was a scream of protest raised by Jerry Yang and others at Yahoo who said, but we can't do that because one may be really hard and difficult, and for another, there are plenty of places in the world, say not France, where this is legal. And who are we to have France dictate the terms? So it's the classic kind of internet dispute that you see with the tech suits, the upsets, like given the status quo as to how easy it is on the ground, in fact, to traffic internationally, say, in non-affiliate. So what happened was you had various responses to this. So somebody invokes the law to restore the status quo. That's how you end up with a case in France about it, because there's some law that, you know, hadn't been invoked all that much, and now suddenly it is being invoked in an unusual circumstance to try to stop it. You also, in some ways, might see tech deployed to restore it. In some way, those who feel aggrieved are using some kind of technology and maybe even starting an arms race with those who are the aggrievers to see who can out tech the other. Certainly, digital music comes to mind as an example. Napster comes about, makes music trade songs, so that Metallica starts spiking Napster directories with fake Metallica songs. And instead of being songs, in fact, it's the voice of Lars saying, why do you want to steal from me? Please, don't download this song. Instead, go to the store and buy the single, support your local heavy metal artist. So that's an example of deploying the tech. And then somebody else finds a way of deploying some kind of software that detects whether what you're about to download is more likely voice or music. And for some kinds of music, that can be an effective way of distinguishing the deep voice from the non-deep voice. In the case of Yahoo France, just to stick with that, we have seen that the French court, not wanting to order Yahoo to do that which is truly technically impossible, that is, ought to comply as care. So they want to see whether or not Yahoo really can somehow filter out the French, if need be. And they appointed three people, one of whom they recognize, Vince Cerf, as active from ICANN, as some of the IETF stuff, also at times called the father of the internet, and other times called the grandfather of the internet. He's the grandfather of the internet. I'm not sure what the intervening generation is. Might be a question to ask Vince if he visits class. But in the meantime, this three-member panel just came back with some recommendations, I believe, today, and told the French court, you know what, despite what Yahoo was telling you and what the conventional wisdom about the internet is, it turns out you actually can maybe not find out who's a dog on the internet, you can find out who is French on the internet. And they had a way, it's basically 86% accurate of distinguishing the French from the non-French on the basis of internet protocol address, the serial numbers, blah, 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 there's some way to do it. And then again, you can imagine that the 15% can be joined by other Frenchmen who start coming up with ways of getting around the way it was used to double there. So that's the kind of arms race you see. Okay. In the meantime, while 3 and 4 are happening to make 2 not count and bring us back to 1, we end up with the fact that the underlying technology is changing. The actual internet environment is itself not the status quo. And we tried a little bit in some of our predictions about the future to look at that, such as the era in which it's very easy to present a digital passport, literally your citizenship and all the facts about you, as you cruise around the web. Thus making it very easy for Yahoo to say, unless you can present me with a passport for a country other than France, we're afraid that we can't let you into this particular auction. And that which had been complete anarchy, maybe you're saying in some of these contexts can be complete control, or vice versa, the technology seems to be one to flip. And a close study of just how the underlying tech is changing and who might be changing it is in order. So the questions we've been asking are 3 and 4 aware of the fact that 5 is going on? Or are they just taking the internet's existence today as a sign that that's the way the internet's going to be forever? And also, who's behind 5? What are the parties and forces that might be in a position to change the entire map rather than skirmish on the map using either legal or technical tools, the things I'm referring to in 3 and 4? So this is, in a nutshell, the theory of this course and the reason why we've been studying what we've been studying, and we'll soon be turning our attention more fully to number 5, looking at the actual underlying tech. And we've seen enough examples of 2, 3, and 4, whether, again, it's privacy, corporate surveillance, that kind of stuff, or copyright, Napster, yada, yada. We've seen enough examples of those to try to project how those battles can be transformed, depending on who has the key. Number 5. All right, so that's where we are. authorize number five, the sorts of changes that there can be on the map, as coming from, right? Who are the people behind number five? Multiple possible sources. Number one is technology as happenstance. It just sort of ended up this way. And if you remember anything from the story of ICANN told in the very first session of this course, a lot of things seem to be up to happenstance. Why do they only make so many serial numbers and not enough to last? Well, they just didn't figure that there would be more needed. Why is it that it's easy to be anonymous? Because it never occurred to them that people would want to have a particular desire to lie about who they were. That's at least the story of the techies and the kind of happenstance. There's also a background of the way it is now is some function of the way it is before. Reminded of the idea that in the United States, when you drive, most of the time, sober, you stay on the right side of the road. And while right is not inherently better than left, that somehow makes it so that fewer crashes happen. And sure enough, there are other countries, Britain, for example, where it is the opposite. And it will be so tomorrow simply because it was so yesterday. I'm not sure if you go through the train, if the trains switch sides midway as you go between Britain and France. We need to ask that to somebody, and I don't yet know the answer to that. If they were ever, of course, to open it up to traffic, kind of like the summer of Callahan, that would obviously be more difficult problem. I'm also told, of course, that these arbitrary things maybe weren't so arbitrary in the beginning, that in Britain, you actually pass on the left because people used to be riding horses, and they used to be knights, and they used to have swords that were right-handed. So you would pass on the right so that you could shake hands as you went past and show that you weren't about to cut off the head of the person you were passing. And if you pass on the left, it would be a lot harder to shake hands, and you could whip out your sword and lock somebody's head off. So really, for a social convention, let alone you pass on the left. And then, of course, when the United States happened, there were fewer knights, and there were teams of horses. And apparently, if you lie on two horses at a time and you sit down, what you want to do to make the horses go is whip them. So to whip the horses, you use your whipping hand, which used to be your sword hand, and to properly whip both horses across the rump, it's better if you sit on the left side of the carriage and whip that way than sit on the right side of the carriage and whip that way. And as a result, people decided that they would start passing on the right because they're sitting on the left. And if you're sitting on the left and driving on the left, you can't tell whether your horses are about to run. Well, I don't know if it's true. Actually, while I'm telling horse stories, I feel like Paul Brontes in a good way. I just pulled this off. It might be apocryphal, about the width of train tracks in the United States. Have you heard about this? Train tracks are apparently 8 feet, 1¾ inches wide. We're not talking about line, this is like Amtrak. And how did that come to be? It's because that's the width that the British tracks were. And how did the British tracks get that way? It's because carriage axles were that large, for horse-drawn carriages. And why were they that wide? Because the ruts in the British roads before there was pavement was that wide. And why were the ruts in the road that wide? Because apparently the Romans had built the roads, and the width of the Roman roads was set by some Roman builder to accommodate Roman chariots. And thus, the American train tracks size themselves to 2,000-year-old Roman chariot tracks. I don't know if it's good, but it makes another good story. I'm saying Paul's seat, that's the problem. And he can sit elsewhere in the room. Okay, so that's tech as happenstance. Next is tech as a result of policy. At some point, we can't rely on our legislators remaining clueless. They don't stay clueless for very long, at least as regards not policy issues, implementation of policy issues. So while today they may be throwing up their hands and saying, my God, how are we going to tax transactions and goods that are otherwise subject to sales tax when they happen over the internet and there's no virtue between the collar and collect the tax, it is a conundrum today. I have a pet theory that says it will not be a conundrum tomorrow for many of the reasons you might be able to find some of the building blocks of our course, that eventually the legislature wises up and can actually learn, instead of just changing people's behavior, you, person, are not supposed to give anonymous threats on the internet, and if we catch you, you're going to be in big trouble. Instead of that kind of ineffectual lawmaking, there are ways maybe such that you could make the technology so that people can't be anonymous even if they want to. Sticking with our transportation and motoring metaphors, we have the idea of speed bumps and seatbelts. Right? Speed bumps are just a way of saying slow down. but they express it through a technology in a way that a simple speed limit sign does not. Depending on the kind of car you have, you will in fact slow down upon approaching the speed bump, even if you don't want to, because you treasure your shock absorbers and the contents of your car. Is that a lecture that's almost coming or something? I don't know. If anybody is surfing, I urge you to stop, just on general principles. But if you happen to surf the site and get incredible exit polling results, you may interrupt the class and share them. Otherwise, you're all going to be instant messaging anyway. So, the charge of credit for this is just we're all curious what's about to happen. Okay, so there are speed bumps, and then seatbelts as well. Now, in some ways, the market may run naturally for seatbelts. That's tech part three here. But in some ways, it doesn't. I don't know how many of you remember cars before there were those lap belts. And I mean, you know, what were people thinking? What were the car manufacturers thinking? You know, you would just, the car would stop, your sternum would be crushed, your head would hit the glove compartment, or perhaps the spiked ornamentation on the steering wheel. It's the same people that built those bicycles that had gear shifts right here, which the cabin glass may have found a problem with that. So, anyway, occasionally we have policy that says somehow the market is failing or people aren't demanding what they want in the market, and as a matter of policy, we will make certain requirements upon the technology. And certainly, before you become a car manufacturer, I don't know many of you do want to be lawyers, but if you're going into the car manufacturing business, you may familiarize yourself with some of the regulations that are on point before you simply build a car. Okay, and then finally, there's technology that gets invented or changed or evolved simply as a result of the market. And many would say, certainly, that's the story of the internet, at least once it got out of the .edge and the .org era. That was part one. People just puttering around into something that was market-driven. That which gets attention on the internet, that gets investment, is that which is predicted to garner the most demand. And thus, we have market forces that fuel the engine of progress. And certainly, just sticking with our transportation metaphor, motorcycles may be that way. I typically ask my sports class the following conundrum, and it usually keeps them under for several weeks. Why is a motorcycle not a defective car? Why is a motorcycle not a defective car? It's a puzzle. It seems that actually if you sold a car with only two wheels, you could be in big trouble. And then you call Microsoft a motorcycle. That's why that was really a Freudian slip. Okay, so that's technology as a result of the market. Now I have sort of a fourth category, respectable distance from the other three. Technology as a result of quote-unquote private policy. What the hell is private policy? Well, we already talked about tech as a result of government policy. You know, Ralph Nader bangs about kitchen pans, and eventually somebody passes a law after reading unsafe at any speed and getting kind of up in arms about it that says, okay, we have to have safer cars, or, you know, something happens to the tort system. But if, in fact, you end up with a market that ends up with a dominant player, or with players acting in concert, whether they act in concert for sort of noble reasons, let's all agree on a single standard here, so we're not working against each other. Think about the flange on an AC cord. It is a coincidence that every product happens to have the same kind of power cord. You know, is that an antitrust problem? Probably not. So they act in concert, or if you've got one market player so big that he or she can set the standards, then maybe we're in a different zone. Maybe there's some different tools we should bring to bear on studying the evolution of the technology and where it is likely to go, and where it might go that would vary from the classic market model if there were truly competition. And I call it a separate category. Now, if this were a business school course, or solely a business school, we would just talk about competition and antitrust in terms of winners and losers, and maybe the policy element would be, are we getting the best software we can possibly get out of the people who make software, for example? And one answer would be, well, how well is the market functioning? Except if it functions well, we're getting better software. If it's not functioning so well, we're not. We're at least in this course is interested in policy ramifications. Are there reasons other than just capturing market for which the single player may make one decision or another? Is there a private policy that could be made? One harbinger of this may be so-called real names, a substitute for domain names, where there's a company that simply gives away names or sells names, and To sell the name is to associate that name with you. That's if you're the buyer. And what it means to associate it with you means that if somebody asks that company who's associated with the name, they will reliably answer that it is you, the buyer. And then the only problem is how do you get that question asked a lot by people? One way might be to stick it into the Internet Explorer browser so that if you type in the location bar a word that does not have dots in it, and that therefore is probably not a domain name, Microsoft, instead of telling you what you're talking about, this isn't a domain name, will hopefully say, you know what, that might be a Microsoft keyword. And let's see if anybody has paid us to take you to a place on the basis of that keyword. That then results in a form of policy making, at least to the extent that ICANN is doing policy making when it decides who gets what top-level domain and who does not. So anyway, that's really the interest we have as we are about to zoom in from 50,000 feet here and actually study the Microsoft case. Any questions on this much or election results? No? Okay. All right, so we figured we might as well start. I know this is sort of brace yourselves. There's some law. So here we have the Sherman Antitrust Act, written in an era when laws were short. This is before word processors and other sort of technological thing that has an effect on law. So it actually, you know, you really had to have your scribe go to work to write this stuff out. So the Sherman Antitrust Act is mercifully brief and perhaps as a result somewhat vague. Here is section one, trusts, etc. I love it, trusts, etc. In restraint of trade, illegal penalty. Compared to the statute we're looking at on human vehicles allocating 4 3/8% of a particular royalty from a blank tape sale to a particular interest group. So every contract, combination, the form of trust or otherwise, or conspiracy and restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or the foreign nations is declared to be illegal. I love it. Declared to be illegal. Every person shall make any contract or engage in any combination or conspiracy hereby declared to be illegal. I mean, he's guilty of felony and bad things happen. Lots of fines and imprisonment and stuff like that. So that's Section 1 of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And a classic example of Section 1 is the smoke-filled room in which the people about to bid on a garbage hauling contract get together. And they all agree to roughly put in the same bid so that whoever wins doesn't get bid down to their marginal cost, which is picking up garbage. Or milk producers get together outside of a state-mandated milk board, and I don't really have anything with local people, but they get together apart from the milk board and say, we're just going to fix prices. You know, you can have all of the Safeways, and I'll get all of the Stop and Shops, and to prevent people from running to the Stop and Shop to buy my milk instead of yours, we're just going to set up a price, and we'll just be the two producers in town, and we can make more together. This is the spirit of cooperation. Then we can, we're constantly fighting with each other, wasting money on sort of negative ads about each other's milk, getting into these formal disputes about cows. Let's just get together, fix a price, and get lazy. That's also, by the way, one of the motivations here. Why is there a Sherman Antitrust Act? We hate high prices. We don't like them. We'd rather that the market act will lower prices and competition is not to do that. And we also have some aversion to laziness. And if there's some way in which people can get together and just fix each other's wagons, so that there is an agreement that you don't need to compete, not only my prices go up, but people will get lazy. The quality of the milk will go down. You experience this. Can you think of a nearby dining establishment that has a monopoly on location and for which the quality of the food and the sprightliness of the service may fall below that which you would expect elsewhere? That's what I'm thinking of Fenway Park. Okay, so that's section one of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Let's jump to section two. This is the only two sections I will be sharing with you today. Monopolizing trade, felony, and penalty. Every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine and conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among several states, yada, 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 goes to jail, bad things happen. All right, so what does it mean to monopolize? Well, one thing to realize is you may remember from reading my piece, which was assigned for today, is that it's okay to have a monopoly. It may raise eyebrows, but to have a monopoly is not itself actionable. Now, what does it mean to have a monopoly? Just to make it interactive. Can anybody take an antitrust in the room? Wow, anybody want to take antitrust in the room? So, all right, so somebody was actually taking it. Marianne O'Brien, tell us what Monopoly is. With no reference to the mustachio of man with the drinking suit.
Well, Monopoly is where you have such dominance in the market in terms of the market share that you can essentially set the price. You can raise the price to whatever you want it to be and collect the rents therefrom. So, usually you look at where you have one company in the market is the prime example, but you might have someone who's nearly one in the market and has 98% of the market share. Someone else is two, and they'd be sufficient because they have the power to set the price.
So the key aspect, as Marianne says, is market share. If you look at what people are buying, it turns out all of them are buying the same product. That is a good proxy for whether a monopoly exists. Now, it turns out that technically, you might want another ingredient, because it might be that everybody goes to the same restaurant for food and has the perfect market share for lunch in Harvard Square. Not because there isn't competition with someone else's market, because it happens to have the secret sauce. It's got the best food, the best chef, at the lowest prices, and it's doing the right thing, and as a result, people use them. United Airlines has the best on-time record. They have great service, and that's why people fly United. So the extra ingredient we tend to look for is to ask a further question, which is the market contestable? You may have high market share, but do we have a sense that for some reason that high market share is not contestable? It would be difficult for somebody else to come along and challenge you. So in the event you have a highly popular restaurant in Harvard Square, were we to hypothesize or even see a comparable restaurant open up next door, we have reason to think that it's easy for such a restaurant to exist, and if it did, would it in fact, or does it, take away patrons from the high market share restaurant? So contestable market is what it's about. Now, once you have a monopoly then, defined as we defined it as a high market share, which is difficult to contest, and actually it's too bad Michael Bean isn't here, because airlines can be a good example because he was now somewhere screaming bloody murder when this is. But it turns out that because of the limitation on gates and the number of planes you can cram into a single piece of airspace, though apparently the FAA has not realized this yet, because there are limits, it limits the amount of competition that can take place. You simply can't have that many airlines traveling between Boston and New York, and thus, last we checked, unless you go with the Harvard price accommodation discount, is $450 round trip between Boston and New York City on the U.S. Airways shuttle, which of course doesn't reflect how much it costs them. It's a little top skip and jump. They really launch these things on catapults to get from one city to another. Okay, so once you have an anomaly, what I've said is it's not itself illegal. Instead, we now look, if you are a monopolist, to see if you are engaging in certain so-called bad behaviors. A certain a little extra bump. So what it means is, with privilege comes responsibility. Membership, monopoly, has its responsibilities as well as its privileges, and you are under somewhat heightened legal scrutiny. There are certain things you're not allowed to do that a scrappy competitor might be allowed to do as a result of achieving monopoly status. And these are two examples of bad behaviors. One is so-called tying. And tying behavior, over which there is some conflict, as you may have read in the rules. Tying behavior is when you take the product for which you have a monopoly, we hypothesize, which is to say, people need it, and they're going to have to get it from you if they want it. That product, you then insist that they buy with some other product. If you want milk at the store, and I'm the only person that's going to give you milk, you have to get our deal whereby you buy orange juice along with the milk. And for competing orange juice producers who don't make milk, because remember you're the only milk person in town, this is a deal that is hard for them to compete against. There's not a whole lot they can do because they can't offer milk. In the meantime, people need milk. They get the OJ. They may not like the OJ so much, but it's not so bad that they pour it down the sink and pretend they didn't get it. And as a result, they stick with the lesser OJ because of the tying behavior. And thus, could a monopoly perhaps be extended because the competing orange juice makers end up no longer making so much orange juice because nobody's buying it because they're all buying milk that comes with orange juice, And after a while, the orange juice market is looking an awful lot like the milk market, and you've got the same monopolies behind it both. Now, there is, to be sure, some conflict among theorists, particularly those coming from Chicago, as to whether the story I told is actually a compelling one. But we won't get into that right now. Let's just understand that, at least in some books, client behavior is a no-no during novels. Second is maintenance. There are certain behaviors that you can't engage in designed to keep the monopoly going. And sometimes monopolies can keep going on their own force. That, at least, is the story of the QWERTY keyboard, as one of the two authors explained it, and as the other author vehemently denies, a wonderful conflict of literatures, quite an intrigue over this QWERTY keyboard story. I urge you to read it if you haven't yet. So there are certain natural ways in which success breeds success. Monopoly can beget further monopoly. And there are certain so-called unnatural, perverted ways in which it can happen. And those are the ways that get especially singled out by the law. And the best example may well be, and I'll leave it up to you to decide, the story of the Microsoft case itself. So with that, why don't we get into the case? This may look familiar from an earlier session of the course. This was sort of my layered picture of the general purpose PC. It turns out that under the conceptual hood of the PC, there are different parts. You've got the chip. Somebody makes the chip, and that has basic instructions that come in and out. And then under the chip, or on top of the chip, there is the basic input-output system that takes care of certain key features. And you've got to have that in there, otherwise it's like trying to put the ingredients to a cake together without a bowl. You've got to have a bowl, and a particular kind of bowl, a particular size bowl, if you're going to make a particular kind of cake. So there's only a couple BIOSes out there that you might use. And I have a little alarm clock there, because typically, for example, it's the basic input-output system that runs interference with the computer's clock and figures out what time it is. Okay, on top of that, in a typical computer, you have the OS, the operating system. And what is the operating system? But maybe best thought of, and there's been huge dispute in the Microsoft case as to what is the operating system, as we're about to see. But one way it may be best thought of is as a bundle of things that are conveniently written once so that others who are writing software for the machine don't have to write it themselves. You can stand on the backs of giants as you write software. And if the operating system handles all of the Byzantine procedures about installing a printer and knowing how many pages the printer has inside, and it's out of paper not to continue throwing data at the printer, that kind of stuff that if you want to just write a good word processor, you don't want to have to deal with, let the OS deal with it. And most OSes have in them some means of dealing with printers. What that means is you can write software, and instead of having to deal with printers, you punt. There's just a point in the software where you punt to the operating system, and you have to know who's going to receive it. You have to write with some particular operating system in mind, because the different systems, say Linux, you've heard about, or Windows of various flavors, or Macintosh, all have different ways in which you're supposed to kick to them. So if you're writing software, you've got to decide pretty early on for whose operating system you are writing. And that API thing up there are basically the rules of hunting. It's the application programming interface. That's the big manual that you don't see that comes with Windows. It's intended for the eyes of someone in the business of writing software. Word processors, email programs, Tetris, you name it. Whatever it might be, they're going to look to the APIs so that they know how to punt, which they'll do quite frequently as they write their code, and let the operating system worry about a whole bunch of stuff. All right, questions on that much? All right, so this is a kind of interesting dance that takes place. Now, when you first come up with an operating system, say t equals 0, there is as yet no dominant operating system. You want to make it as appealing as possible to the marketplace. How do you do that? Well, for one thing, you make it very easy to be punted to. You try to make it an efficient system, one that isn't buggy, all sorts of things you expect. And you also want to make sure that as many developers as possible are interested in writing stuff for your system. Because the more developers who write for you, the more software will be available for that system. And in turn, then, somebody selecting a computer, and often the selection of a computer computer is in fact the selection of an operating system. It's not easy to change your mind after you buy your computer and say you want to run a different operating system. You will go with the computer as a consumer that offers you the most software, or the best software, or the most compatible software. And to the extent that one operating system has a lot more software to it, it's like a video game that has a lot more cartridges. You'd rather have that with it than one that does not. And in fact, you then experience some kind of what you might call tipping behavior. Because after a while, by hook or by crook, somebody ends up with a popular operating system, which then means that more people buy it. And in turn, more developers, who can only put resources into writing one kind of software for one platform, figure they'll write to the predominant operating system, because that is the system that most people out there have, and that will thus maximize their purchases of the software, and thus does the operating system get one more piece of software to make it appealing to those who haven't yet bought an operating system. So the more people who join in, the more powerful the system gets, and in turn, the more powerful it gets, the more appealing it is to join in. This is the so-called path dependence theory. We saw the fax machines too. As we've said before, a fax machine standing alone is essentially a telephone with a waffle iron attached. But as soon as you get more people with fax machines, you can start faxing back and forth. And under Metcalfe's law, we say that each added node of the network doubles the utility of the network because it makes for double the number of connections that take place, because everybody in the network can suddenly connect to that new extra node, and thus does the network become more appealing. All right, so questions on this one? I don't know if this is making sense, or if people are as laconic as they were yesterday. Either some form of sense or something. Okay. So, how do we cut to the Microsoft case? It turns out there's not just one Microsoft case, there's a whole constellation of Microsoft cases. And I'm going to try to give you a quick history of them. So, the first case, DOJ v. Microsoft. This was actually about DOS. What is DOS? How do you remember DOS? DOS is what came before Windows, right? And it was, its hallmark was C:\greater than. That was DOS. In fact, maybe I can put our presentation to this and coax. And definitely make a presentation to this here. Coax this computer showing us DOS. There is DOS in all its glory, or some version of DOS. And you know, you could do things like GIR, really cool. And you know, you could type out files or something. You know, it was really clumsy. Alright, so that was DOS. And what was it? It was an operating system. It was a bundle of functions, some of which you saw by looking at that prompt. So you could type a word and it would make something happen, like DIR would show you what was inside a folder. Other things you might do as a software developer is, again, use those hidden things like printers and screen sizes and stuff like that. So if you wanted to buy software, you had to have DOS in order for it to work, if it was software written for DOS. And after a while, DOS became quite popular. Now, as I may have mentioned in an earlier class, I hope I'm not myself, but I am maybe really clear at the same time, there wasn't just Microsoft DOS. Right, I'm talking about digital research, maybe on Free Software Day. Digital research came up with DR-DOS that had essentially the same APIs. It wasn't using the same code, but it was using the same interfaces. It placed the punter functionally in the same place to receive the kick, such that a kicker, which is to say a software program, would be indifferent as to whether it was the Microsoft receiver or the DR-DOS receiver standing there to receive the kick. And as a result, DR-DOS was a pretty good substitutable product at zero marginal cost to produce, no less, once you covered the fixed costs of developing the thing, and could provide serious competition to MS-DOS. And then at some point, too, Microsoft would try to make a change to MS-DOS, a new feature, and if enough people had DR-DOS, it would be an unsuccessful introduction of the feature, because only half the people would be able to use it if they're writing software. You think carefully before using the feature that would make your software only compatible with half the people out there, rather than all of them. So this was a serious threat to Microsoft, and they responded to it in a classic take-no-prisoners kind of way. They sent something to OEMs. An OEM, right? An original equipment manufacturer. Compaq or Dell. The kinds of people from whom we buy computers. And to ship a computer out the door, Dell or Compaq, and you have not bothered to put an operating system on, as we've seen, it's a doorstop. There's nothing you can do with it. You get it, you try to run, you know, your favorite John Madden golf program or something, and nothing happens because John Madden golf expects to have DOS, at the very least, in order to run it. So Compaq, while they know how to get cheap circuit boards and put them together and do good ad campaigns for them and everything else, absolutely needs to have the operating system if it is to have the an operating system, a computer that somebody wants to buy. With DOS being the prevailing awesome time, they had to put DOS on it. But now we've seen DR-DOS can substitute. So Microsoft said, well, we're going to come up with a new rule. If you want to license even one copy of Microsoft DOS from us, because a couple of your customers are picky and are going to want to see that it's, you know, MS-DOS inside, kind of like Intel inside, you have to license it for every single computer that rolls off your assembly line. So-called per processor license. So we will not charge you on the basis of how many copies of MS-DOS you wish to install on respective computers. We will simply charge you on the number of processors that leave your factory destined for a customer. And that means that if you want if you want to put DR-DOS on a computer, you've got to pay twice. Once for MS-DOS you're not going to install, and again for DR-DOS. And that's not a deal that Compaq wanted to do. And as a result, because enough of them wanted at least a few MS-DOSes, they had to sign up for all of them, and DR-DOS was losing what small market share it had. And thus did the Department of Justice enter the fray. Well, it's a commercial break. I'll be reviewed, will be reviewed, which is itself a review. Well, that here comes this thing again. This is a funny sound. All right, so 1995 to 96, is the consent decree case. This is what we're just about to talk about. After that, we have the contempt case. Then we have the contempt case. Then we have the antitrust case. All right, so here we're talking about the DOS monopoly. And what happened was the government went after them. The investigation was launched. Many government hours were spent. Harvard Law School interns worked on both sides of the case. And you ended up with an agreement. The government threatening to sue them under the Sherman Act, saying you are engaged in a Section 2 violation. You are engaged in unlawful monopoly maintenance, Microsoft. Microsoft said, well, we don't think we are, but maybe you've got us, so let's come up with a plea agreement, essentially, a consent decree. And a consent decree is a rather long document, has a bunch of things. A lot of pieces of the document talk about per processor this, you're not allowed to charge like that anymore, that kind of thing. But here's one highly relevant section of the consent decree. It says, under Section 4E, Microsoft shall not enter into any license agreement with an OEM in which the terms of that agreement are expressly or impliedly conditioned upon, one, the licensing of any other covered product, operating system, software product, or other product, which makes you wonder why they bought it in categories 1 and 2, provided after this provision in and of itself shall not be construed to prohibit Microsoft from developing integrated products. Can you tell kind of like the people on Sesame Street for which one someone on the left would say one thing and one on the right would say the other? Which part came from whom? Which, you know, the word smithing that went on? Now what is this about? What this was about at the time was a worry that DOS was dying, which it was. Even Microsoft knew it. And the question was, if we have a future for which it looks like people just don't want to commune with a command line anymore, what will be the predominant operating system? And Microsoft wanted it to be theirs. Remember, Macintosh had long had this graphical user interface that people were starting to take some yen towards. So the worry here was that Windows 95 was about to come out. And in the meantime, Windows 3.1 was out. And Windows 3.1 was a very bad implementation of what we know as the Mac interface. I don't know how people use Windows 3.1 for a time. I worked at Microsoft the summer of 90, when I guess 3.1 was just about to come out. And it's an operating system. It's one for which there was very little software available. It was just brand new. So Microsoft knew they couldn't ship computers just with Windows 3.1 on them, because nobody had anything to do. So they just figured they could do two for one. They could have Windows 3.1 and DOS on it. And in fact, Windows 3.1 really was just DOS with pretty pictures. So that way, if you had Windows 3.1, you would see some of these pretty windows, and then you double click on John Madden Golf, you'd be back to a text program again. You find yourself on a green, there is a monster here. You know, what do you want to do? So Microsoft sends out DOS and Windows on their computers. And the worry was, is there some way they could leverage an existing monopoly into a monopoly on the next generation? For example, could they insist that anybody who wanted to buy DOS, because that was quite popular, would have to buy Windows 3.1 as well? That sounds like time, doesn't it? If you want DOS, sorry, you're going to have to take 3.1 with it. And then enough people get 3.1 out there that what had formerly been useless is no longer so useless, because now there's an installed base for which software developers can start writing. You can imagine going the other way around, too. If you want Windows 3.1, because we know that's the next greatest thing, you have to take DOS. And you can't have DR DOS instead. If you want 3.1, you're going to have Microsoft DOS, even though DR DOS could work just as well with it. And that's a way to milk what last few remaining drops there were from the DOS market, rather than letting Visual Research get an edge. So, all right, this was put in, we assume, to stop that kind of thing from happening. You can't have an agreement with these OEMs in which you condition the licensing of one product on the licensing of any other covered product, operating system, software product, or some other product. That was the idea. You couldn't force both into the OEM's hands. And then Microsoft got this parenthetical ad. Provided under this provision, in and of itself should not be considered for Microsoft for developing integrated products. What does that mean? Well, Windows 95, and even to this day, Windows, I think, is 98 on this machine, I was able to call up DOS, right? I mean, here, at some risk of restarting our presentation, there's DOS. It's sitting on this computer. Because Windows 95 or 98 was installed. And in fact, when I asked for the version, very cleverly, it doesn't say that this is DOS, even though it stands right where that DOS pump receiver used to stand. It says this is Windows 98, version 4.10.1998. Why does this say Windows 98? It's not, right? It's DOS. And if I hazard a guess, this is like an easy pump. Brian.
Because DOS version 8.0 would be very unpopular with the government on that particular tying arrangement, because they just see that if this is DOS that you have here, you tie the DOS to the Windows, and that's another.
So this is an integrated product. This is all one product that has a window that has a C prompt. But it's not DOS. It's Windows 98 command line mode. This is an integrated product. Now, at some point, the consent decree, again, now I'm going backwards, right, that's before this, the consent decree comes before Judge Sporkin to approve. Under the Little Known Honey Act, the government may come up with a deal with Microsoft to avoid the case. What they technically do is file the case, and on the very same day, say, by the way, we've settled it, and here's the consent decree. We enter the consent decree with the court, it's kind of like filing a deed, the register of deeds, we really mean it. It's not just some kind of informal contract between the then prosecutor at the time and Microsoft at the time. It is a formal agreement for which the court is, under the terms of the Honey Act, supposed to look at it, bring it into a wide grin, and stamp yes on it. That's the way the Honey Act is supposed to work. The court is supposed to just say, great, whatever you guys think. And as I may have related to clear the process. I don't know why I'm having such amnesia about past classes. Have I told you about Stanley Sporkin's reaction to this thing? No. Stanley Sporkin, affectionately as Sporky to some of his DC District Court colleagues, took one look at this and had just read a book called Hard Drive, which was a collection of rumors and things about Microsoft acting nastily to people, especially willfully monopolizing, maintaining a monopoly through the practice of vaporware. What was vaporware? But some promising young upstart company that had just gotten funding would make an announcement they were about. They were 3 weeks away from releasing a new and exciting program that people would want. Microsoft would then issue a press release the next day that says, we're working on that, actually, and it will be fully compatible with Windows, and you can trust the Microsoft brand. At that point, all funding would drop from the original company, and Microsoft would never get around to writing the program that they had promised. That was the vaporware story. Now, the government offered no evidence that there was any such thing as vaporware going on, although you can find plenty of people claiming there was. Plenty of people say that the vaporware story is itself a vapor story. But Stanley Sporkin read Hard Drive and came to the court wanting to talk about it. So this proceeding to approve under the Tunney Act, this consent decree, became, it's a wonderful transcript, I urge you to read it at some point. I think we actually have it online, give the URL. A long disquisition about Hard Drive and vaporware, with baffled lawyers on both sides trying to answer charges that neither had levied against the other. And eventually Stanley Sporkin said, this agreement is not in the public interest. I'm sending you both back to the table to come up with a better agreement. Come on, DOJ, you can do better than what you did. You then have the unusual procedural circumstance in which DOJ and Microsoft both appealed the judge's ruling on the same side. And the D.C. Circuit, in a notable opinion on appeal, told Judge Sporkin that he had erred gravely, and in fact erred so gravely that on remand, they remanded the case to a different judge. Talk about a stinging slap in the face. We don't even trust you now that we have handed you a rubber stamp and applied a manacle to your wrist to actually lower it. And Sam, what are you going to do for Judge Jackson to do? Judge Jackson came in and said, I don't know, stamp's a thing, and it's done. So thus we have a consent decree entered under the Tunney Act. Okay, so fast forward to the contempt case. What's the contempt case about? Now, in some ways, I faked you out a little bit, because you thought the contempt case was going to be about that little Windows that just appeared and said the version of DOS was Windows 98. In fact, the government let that slide. The DOS wars were over. DR-DOS has long since been returned. It is not going to be rising from the grave. And in fact, who cares, right? How many people are writing John Mandel in DOS mode today? So that never came up again as an issue. However, what you did have was the browser wars. You had, by all accounts, Microsoft getting a little bit lazy, enjoying churning out increasingly bloated versions of word processors and spreadsheets and operating systems, and sort of forgetting about the internet revolution that was in progress. And what was really the point of the question was that I've claimed the internet revolution happened in late 94, early 95, with the advent of popularity of Netscape. That kind of crappy mosaic browser became a lot more robust as Netscape took it up, and you actually had a sort of path dependence take place there. More and more people would get the browser and then use it. That meant that you were thinking of putting up a website, there were that many more people trying to look at it, and as a result, you would choose to put information out on the internet for the world at large using protocols that the Netscape browser was designed to use. It's exactly that kind of thing. There was a time when it was not clear that browsers as we know them would be the way that people generally get information on the internet. It might have been WISE, the Wide Area Information System, and partly fortunate it wasn't. I think there still is a WISE, but it's just a scenario with my parents that use it. So we have the web instead, and the Netscape browser was the primary way of getting into that worldwide web. So Microsoft decides at some point, a la perhaps the vaporware rumor I repeated, that they want to get into this action as well. Now Netscape had already gone into a strategy of giving their browser away. And as we discussed briefly yesterday with our friend who worked for Netscape, why were they giving away the browser? How were they expecting to make money on it? Well, they were maybe hoping to make money later, give it all away, and once everybody's stuck with it and all these websites are written in it, then you can type the news and start charging on the way. That didn't seem to be their strategy. Rather, it was either, well, we'll get a lot of people on it and then charge some. This is price discrimination now. Those, for instance, who want a manual with it, or those who want a special edition. Remember Netscape Gold? There's Netscape, and then there's Netscape Gold. And so maybe that's how it's structured the market. Or maybe we'll do this server and browser thing, so that the more browsers there are out there, the more we can write a server especially designed to interact with that browser. And then, not only won't there likely be competing browsers, there won't be competing servers, because other people's servers will be kind of like DR dumps. Little siblings will always be playing catch-up to our servers as we do enhancement. It was a good strategy, one worthy of the one that Bill Gates and himself and Priscilla DOS. And that's what Netscape was happily doing. So at some point, Microsoft decides they want in on this. Now, you can tell that story with any number of software applications. There used to be companies that made solitaire programs. And then somehow, it got bundled with Windows 3.1 and then Windows 95. And the minute Microsoft makes a decision to implement solitaire, and some intern wrote over 2 months in the summer, if you're selling a solitaire program, you don't forget it. Even without network effects, right? Solitaire, by definition. You don't have to be compatible with anybody else's solitaire. Somehow, it is already coming with you, right? It's just like tying. You only want so much orange juice, and it comes with Windows 3.1. So there goes solitaire. Now, the government wasn't willing to go back over solitaire, even though it was urged to, and over a couple other sort of insignificant programs we'll never hear of, because they died a quiet and sad death. So Microsoft's integrating more and more programs into its operating system. But it did want to go to work with the browser. And I think there is a reason why. This will get to why this all matters. But I'm going to tell you why it matters only after I drag you through the minutiae of the actual doctrinal claims in the case. So at least accept for a moment that the government has decided that, you know what, Netscape can be in trouble, even though at the moment of bringing this action, they seem to have overwhelming market share, but it's starting to be increasingly contested by Microsoft's Internet Explorer, which at the time, by many accounts, at least certainly mine, which I offer what it's worth, was not nearly as good as Netscape. That has completely changed. And even the former Netscape partisans seem fairly unwilling to rise to any spirited defense of Netscape as a software product. But at that time, Netscape was where it was at. So what was Microsoft doing? Well, Microsoft has the lock on the operating system, at least for those shipping Intel processors out the door. That means Compaq and Dell and blah, blah, blah. They know that they want to have their computers leave the door with Windows 95 or Windows 98 installed on them. Now, once that hits the consumer wants to get onto the internet, how does the consumer do that? Now, the overriding principle appears to be consumers are idiots. They're rank idiots. They don't even know how to enable content filtering in the Internet Options panel of the current Internet Explorer. Maybe they don't want to, but even if they did want to, especially those who want to, are probably exactly the types who wouldn't know how to. All right. Given that fact, the first few pretty pictures and icons that a consumer is exposed to when first unpacking this thing from the crate may well determine what the consumer does. So Microsoft said that initial desktop, the stuff you see when you take it out of the crate, is part and parcel of the quality of Windows 95. And we will look askance at those OEMs who mess with that. If you want to add something to the desktop, we're going to be pretty upset, because what it might mean is that if somebody calls Microsoft for help after installing their system, and we tell them to click on the third icon to the right, we want to rest assured that it's the one we put there, and not the one that Compaq, as the middleman, bundling this operating system with their computer, is then turning it over to the consumer. So in the interest of product integrity, we are going to put into our licensing agreements with the OEMs, the agreements by which we agree to give them the operating system for a price, certain restrictions on how they are and aren't to install it. So one restriction is, we You may not remove anything from the desktop that is there. So if there should happen to be an icon that says Internet Explorer, you can't get rid of it. There's an icon that says Solitaire. You can't get rid of it. The only way to offer Windows to your customers is the way we pack it and with the stuff we pack it with. Even if you wanted to pay us more to get rid of this stuff, we're not interested. Then it was sort of the idea, it is a wonderful kind of side story. People want to get on the internet. Before they even choose a browser, they have to choose an internet service provider. That was the way it worked. You buy the computer, and then you, well, who's going to provide the internet service? Originally over modem. So Microsoft was in a position to do it. They had something called the dial-up connections folder. And you would go to the dial-up connections folder, and there would be a little set of icons, each of which represented a potential internet service provider to do business with. Now, if you are an internet service provider looking for business, you've got to get yourself in that folder. If you're not in the folder, you are left with having to drop floppy disks out of helicopters and hope that people walk them over the computer and ask them, so it's too late, because they got the computer 2 days ago and they already double-clicked on the internet connections folder and they got a worse deal with AT&T or something. You've got to get yourself in that folder. So Microsoft went around like somebody selling charity chocolate bars on a street, down to each house, each person with an ISP, and said, would you like to be in the internet connections folder? You know, what do you bid? And they would bid things to be in the internet connections folder. And eventually there's a folder full of internet connections. And then wonderfully, in a later version of Windows 95, they decided to get rid of the internet connections folder, which is to say they left it there. They fumed their contract. But instead, when you first turn on the computer, a box pops up and says, would you like to get on the internet? And if you say yes, it runs the internet connection wizard, which bears no relationship whatsoever to the internet connections folder. So then they went down the street for a second round. Oh, you're in the folder. Don't worry. That was yesterday's deal. Would you like to be an internet connection wizard? Because if you're not in the wizard, nobody's going to click on the folder. Because by the time they see the folder, they've already gone through the wizard and chosen an internet service provider. Now, I just ask you not to answer, but to mull over whether that is simply, hey, all's fair, it's a market, you don't want to do business with them, go talk to the Macintosh people. We know they're losers, but you can, you know, get yourself on their desktop if they agree. Or, you know, you can drop stuff out of helicopters, whatever, it's Microsoft's operating system, isn't it up to them to decide? Or is there some way in which it just doesn't seem fair, right, to use our terminology from web line of days and make it feel creepy? I don't know what makes it feel creepy. It doesn't seem as life and death, maybe as web line might. You can imagine these triangle criteria by which you would decide whether Microsoft is behaving badly. Do they have monopoly? Are they the only game in town, such that the ISP to thumb your nose at them is to put a nail into your own coffin? And if so, all right. Maybe we should scrutinize this deal in a way that we wouldn't scrutinize another kind of deal. So maybe that's a kind of bad behavior deserving of scrutiny. So all right, the internet connection is one thing. I'm going to return to that. But the browser was the other. And the rule was, you've got to have Internet Explorer browser in there. And in fact, the way it worked, because Internet Explorer came so late to Microsoft as a matter of technology, they were shipping Windows 95 CDs that didn't have Internet Explorer on them. If you want Internet Explorer, you either had to download it or install it from a floppy disk or do the same with Netscape. They were competing on even terms to reach those student consumers, to be the first one to shove a disk into their hungry maw and get them to install on a computer, and once they've got it, they're not going to install anything else. So Microsoft eventually started shipping IE CDs with their Windows 95 CDs to the factories, to Compaq, and wrote into their contracts, this is how you are to install Windows 95. Step one, install Windows 95. Step two, install Internet Explorer. Then you will have installed Windows 95. That is the only way to install Windows 95. If you do not do step two, you will be in breach of the contract. We will have remedies against you in court, or we'll simply stop shipping you Windows 95 CDs, and then what are you going to do? That was the situation as the government found it when it started the contempt case. And the government's argument was, by engaging in this practice, Microsoft was in contempt of the original consent decree that had to do with DOS and Windows 3.1. And here's what they said in their complaint. Microsoft has continued to violate Section 4E1 of the final judgment by requiring OEMs to license and reinstall Internet Explorer 3.0 as a condition of licensing Windows 95. Moreover, Microsoft will violate that section in the future by requiring OEMs license distributing 4.0 as a condition of licensing Windows 95. And it's clear because there are the agreements, and it's violating licensing Windows 95, which is the common product, and the agreements are currently conditioned on Explorer 3.0 or 4.0, and that's another product. And it's not an integrated product within the meaning of the final judgment, and so here's our facts, and that's why you're in contempt. So Judge Jackson, hold them in contempt. So let's take a reprise, especially for over three, especially since I'm starting at a course. Somebody tell me whether, of the story as I've told it, this seems a compelling account of the complaint. If you're Judge Jackson sitting here looking at this, what do you think? Let me turn to my paper-based cold call machine. I guess something required you've done the readings. I told you the whole story. Darren Schulman, are you here? Where is Darren? Oh, poor Darren is not here. Allow me to make a conspicuous mark that I've got plenty. I'm going to do an interview with DOJ. Yeah, he's doing something. But... All right. Let's try Allison Margolin. Yep. No good deed goes unpunished. Use the microphone. You can all hear. Yes, it's my fault. Judge Jackson, guess this thing. What do you think? Let's pretend this was just a rhetorical question. You are a clerk to Judge Jackson, and he says, I don't understand. What the hell is a covered product? I don't know what this is. I'm technology ignorant. I'm at a foot point special master here. Before I do, Allison, what do you think? What should I do with this claim?
I think that it's in my kind of technologically unknowledgeable opinion, it seems to me that they should be held in contempt, that there's a legitimate claim against Microsoft, because whether or not you can even have the option, I guess, and I don't know if I really understand this, of putting another type of internet browser or any of these things, I don't think the consumer would know that. And I guess tying it together seems to fit within the, I don't know, Sherman antitrust, monopoly, one of those things that we were just discussing. So it seems to me that it would fit. I don't really.
I'm Judge Jackson, I'm not even
I don't really understand how it wouldn't be a legitimate claim. I don't really understand Microsoft's argument too well. I think it seems pretty obvious that there would be something at least bordering on legitimate claim.
Well, one thing that may be confusing, Judge Jackson, is that it's not clear this has anything to do with the Sherman Antitrust Act, does it? This is a consent decree. This is a contract between two parties. Maybe DOJ was threatening them with some other provision of the law. It has nothing to do with the Sherman Act. Do we need to interpret Section 4E1 under the shadow of the Sherman Act, or is it just basically, hey, for whatever reason, Microsoft saw fit to enter into this contract with a party that happens to be the government, and now we just want to see if it should be held in the contract? Yeah, that's good. The rest of you back here.
Can you go back to the consent decree?
I can try. You're asking for something that may be beyond my technical expertise. If you're Microsoft, what are you going to say in answer to this claim? Yeah.
Well, it seems like that there's an obvious tension between the definition of integrated products and the statement at the beginning of each one. And what I find kind of troubling about the applying the consent decree is that basically the government sat down and said, well, this is involved in violation of this consent decree, and it's not an integrated product. Was, it's obvious that Internet Explorer 3 isn't necessary to the operating system. It's obvious you can ship Windows 95 without it. It's obvious you don't need that quote-unquote integrated product to run Windows 95. So therefore, it's one of those other products. It's not an integrated product. But what really troubles me about it is that Solitaire isn't a necessary product to run Windows 95 either. And it seems pretty clear that either through lack of resources or lack of willpower, the government isn't taking Microsoft to task on that. In fact, there's a lot of applications, Telnet, and FTP, and all these other interesting little things that happen with Windows 95 that aren't necessary at all for the operating system to run.
It does highlight that if we can't figure out what integrated product means, or if we can't come up with a definition that doesn't lead to a disaster, we're in trouble. And perhaps if we define integrated product so broadly as to be anything that, as you put it, is not necessary, or a non-integrated product is something that is not necessary to functioning of the operating system, then solitaire is illegal under this agreement. Now you might say, well, Microsoft never inked it. But somehow the idea that they can just get pieces to Windows 95 picked off one by one does seem a little bit unsettling. Now we hear Bill Gates echoing to us, we can't have the government telling us how to write software.
I would actually concur with what you just said, and it just seems to be a huge loophole, this idea of integrated products. I remember when 95, I guess it was a service pack, came out to modify the existing Windows 95 or 98, the browser was pretty tightly integrated into the system. It basically was part of, you could open up, you could double click on my computer, open up a window, and then highlight the address bar and type in a web location, and that would pop up in the same window.
That's funny, I wonder how many people do you think actually
do that? I mean, the interface.
I agree, but that's
was the same.
Why do you think it's the same?
I think that they started to see that the internet was becoming such an integral part of the computer experience.
So we should make it a little Minesweeper. Should you choose to type in an internet address in the Minesweeper window? Here's a website.
or if for whatever reason you wanted to call on a module from Excel, for example, or a spreadsheet module, and pop it into a Word document you're working on or some sort of word processing document. I mean, to me, that would constitute an integrated product. But the DOG would look at it as forcing people to buy into Microsoft's spreadsheet module. I think it's a huge loophole, this idea of integrated products.
All right, so I just want to keep an inventory going. So far, we have two, at least, definitions of integrated product. Number one definition is what it's not, which is hopefully not everything. And anything that seems to lean on that is a problem. And then another definition we have, which runs afoul of definition one, is anything not necessary for the functioning of the actual operating system. If we were to go with that definition, not only would it run afoul of one, you could imagine that the case then would hinge on a battle of the experts. You could comp sci professors from departments of elite universities coming in to say whether an operating system, X or Y, belongs, or whether it doesn't. There'd be some orthodoxy about what goes into or doesn't go into an operating system. Is there any other metric, criteria we could use to figure out whether something's integrated or not? I don't know if you had a suggestion on that or another comment.
No, my comment was just that definition would have make it so wide open that the behavior that clearly the consent agreement was designed to prevent, for example, with Word or Excel, becoming integrated into the operating system as well. I mean, it's limitless, absolutely. Why would we have a consent agreement so limitless?
So that's the counter flag. One flag, pointing out a boundary, is it can't mean everything. The other flag is it can't mean nothing. It's got to mean that if you were to take Microsoft Office and start insisting that that shipped with everything, thereby, not like any help, putting a nail on the coffin of Cordell, Word Perfect, Schmutz, or whatever that thing is, it doesn't work. That would be unfair, and that's exactly the kind of thing for which the consent decree was entered to prevent.
I just want to make a comment, because apparently I remember at the time Microsoft's whole mindset, I'm the lead. A lawyer said as soon as this came out, we just took that created the reason why we had this clause. With this clause, we were pretty much throwing like a ham sandwich.
It was inadvisable. It's almost as bad as Sean Fanning saying, "NAFTA is for piracy."
Right. And so the ham sandwich sort of showed that Microsoft Italian was that by throwing this clause, pretty much read it.
They can integrate a ham sandwich, a physical ham sandwich, into the Microsoft operating system. And there was nothing the Department of Justice or the National Court Council could do about it. That does seem a claim that has some element of humanism to it.
Earlier when we were talking about the Sherman Antitrust Act, you said that a monopoly
You could have a monopoly, but there had to be some element of heightened badness before it was illegal. And maybe we could apply that same rationale here, where, yes, you can give them an operating system that involves a lot of extraneous stuff, like the solitaire program. But when there's an element of heightened badness of saying you can't actually even install Windows 95 until you install Internet Explorer, that's a...
Somehow it seems worse to the OEMs that you're not allowed to start going and fucking around and taking stuff out. You must actually affirm the OEMs. And it certainly makes the line clearer between the Microsoft claim that's about freedom to innovate, don't tell our coders how to code, and the DOJ claim that was don't tell your OEMs how to install your software. Let the OEMs do what they want. Your coders can code all they want, but let the OEMs make some decisions before it leaves the warehouse, and don't try to use the law as a kludge, contracts, to get them to do a certain thing. So this case was all about this word. That's what this aspect of the case was about. It jumped the preliminary injunction stage, and fast forward a little bit, because I know we're starting to move on time. And we get to the judge's order on the preliminary injunction, asking that Microsoft be asked not to insist that IE 3.0 and later 4.0 be bundled with Windows 95. And what he does is he says, I'm not going to hold them in contempt, because it's not by clear and convincing evidence to me that they're actually in contempt of this contract. However, I do think they may be in violation of it. And as a result, I'm going to order, among other things, that we appoint a special master by the name of Larry Lessig, who called me excitedly that evening, said, you're never going to believe what just happened. He said, I get one lawyer I can pick to help me, are you interested? And thus, and I get paid by the U.S. government, judicial branch, not DOJ, to help on the case. He appoints a special master, and then he further orders on his own that Microsoft Corporation's officers, agents, servants, everybody else are hereby enjoined and shall cease and desist from after they draw up from the practice of licensing the use of any Microsoft personal computing operating system software, including 95 and any successor version, on a condition expressed or implied that the licensee also license and pre-install any internet browser software, including 3.0, 4.0, or anything else, pending further order of the court. Does that order seem clear to you? Does it seem clear what Judge Jackson is asking Microsoft to do? Raise your hand if you think yes, it is clear. Wow, what is that clear? Who does not think it's clear? So somebody doesn't think it's clear. Allow me to try to explain. What doesn't seem clear about this? Yeah, push button, you know, okay. Well, one interpretation might be, especially given Karen's point, that I simply tell them, here are the two CDs that will come back. One has Windows 95, the other has IE 3.0. If you want, you can grind the CD2 underfoot. Just don't install it. And just go with Windows 95. That's what you're allowed to do. That's one interpretation of this decree.
But there are others.
And in fact, Microsoft had its own interpretation of the decree. Here is Microsoft's interpretation of the decree. This is just wonderful. I had to show you the letter, a Microsoft letter in it. Ray, recent court ruling. Dear Microsoft OEM customer, on December 11, 1997, Microsoft received a preliminary order from Judge Jackson, blah, 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 concerning our licensing of Windows 95 to computer manufacturers. Paragraph. We wish to assure you that you may continue to pre-install Windows 95 as you have been planning. You are respected Microsoft, not a human, therefore it need not affect your product plans in any way. And then it quotes from the injunction that we just saw, that they're not allowed to condition stuff, and then says, therefore you may pre-install Windows 95 with or without the Internet Explorer portion of the operating system. Now, how do you do that? It says, under the court's order, the options available to you are to pre-install Windows 95 in its entirety
including Internet Explorer 3.0, or to install all of it except for 3.0 as defined by the court. You may not elect to install only selected portions of Internet Explorer 3.0. Our tests indicate if you elect to install the operating system without Internet Explorer 3.0, the resulting program will not boot, and the program will be deficient in other ways. Because Internet Explorer 95, or Internet Windows 95, was designed and developed on the assumption that Internet Explorer 3.0 is an integral part of the operating system. Now, what this letter meant was Microsoft was not letting them omit the second CD. What they had to do was install the second CD, and then if they wanted not to have Internet Explorer 3.0, they were not allowed to just delete the icon on the desktop, which is in fact really what it was all about. They had to go in and delete any file that had been installed as a result of IE 3.0. And not only was IE 3.0 a series of files called IE 3.0, it replaced some Windows 95 system files with modified versions. Those had to be deleted, and you weren't allowed to replace them with the originals. And as a result, the system would not boot. Those are then the choices under Judge Jackson's orders that the software distributors were given. Now you can guess how many people, how many contacts Dell's world chose to change their practices in any way as a result. Thus, we get to the contempt case. Judge Jackson was furious. He felt personally slighted by what seemed an intentional misreading of this case. That's when he was talking about giving them fines of $1 million a day until they finally came to heel. Turns out that actually they make enough, but $1 million a day is not necessarily enough to dissuade them. And at that time, an emergency appeal was taken to the D.C. Circuit saying that Larry Lessig should not be on the case for a variety of reasons, which I won't trace with right now, and saying Judge Jackson got it all wrong. The D.C. Circuit agreed, stayed the contempt case, stayed the contempt case, stayed the special master, thought about it, and then issued an opinion basically saying it's an integrated product, Microsoft is. And if DOJ wants to take it any further, they can forget this whole Section 4E1 consent decree case. They're welcome to come to the front door and file a fresh case under the Sherman Antitrust Act. And that is exactly what DOJ did, and that's what led us to the current case. So the current case is basically a re-allegation of all the stuff from the other one, but instead of saying it's violating 4E1, they're saying it's just violating Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And not only is it a tying case, but it is a monopoly maintenance case. And let me tell you why it's a monopoly maintenance case from the point of view of the government, because that actually gets to the question of why we care about this. And it incidentally gets to the question of how to distinguish Solitaire from Internet Explorer from Minesweeper. It turns out that given our chart before, which I'm sorry I can repeat up here easily, we have this concept of an operating system for which developers have to make a decision. They've got code for one or the other. So there was one company called Sun that got the idea of writing something called Java. Java was somebody who could receive your punts. And the cool thing about it was that Sun would help see to it that Java ran on Windows and ran on Mac and ran on Linux. So once you have Java, which in essence was itself a form of operating system, running on any operating system, you no longer have programmers alone. You could write your software for Java and know that it would work on a Windows machine, a Mac machine, or a Linux machine. That was the vision, at least. It was called write once, run anywhere, TM. That was the idea behind Java. And they, in turn, licensed their Java code to all sorts of people so that it would be usable in the operating systems. And Netscape was the delivery vehicle. The way you would run Java is by having Netscape on your computer, and you would use Netscape to be the window onto the software you wanted to run. Netscape would have Java inside, and voila, you'd be doing spreadsheets in Netscape thanks to the presence of Java. That was the idea. The government's theory said that's why Microsoft wants to dominate the Internet Explorer browser market.
And this is why it matters more than solitaire. It's not just about a particular product that maybe they'll charge more for. It's about defending the monopoly that is Windows 95. Because unless they can kill Netscape, they have a dagger pointed at them. If Netscape becomes a predominant browser, it takes Java with it, and it means that software developers can start writing for Java, and they need not care whether it's a Windows 95 machine or a Mac or anything else. It would be the death knell, possibly, or at least eliminate the path dependence, the QWERTY problem that I described before, on once you have success or being success. Now you can safely buy a Mac and know that you still have something to run on it, so long as you can run Netscape and in turn can run Java, and there are people writing stuff for Java who might well do it because it will also work on the Windows platform. That was what made this difference as a government, and why this isn't really a case about tying, it's a case about maintaining a current monopoly, and the bad behavior is shoving Internet Explorers down everybody's throats through the act of forcing it onto the desktop. The other act alleged was because when you use AOL, sometimes you don't use Netscape, you don't use IE, you use the AOL browser. Turns out that AOL doesn't want to have the right browser, so they've seen somebody's engine, they can slap their own shellac over it called AOL. And originally they were going to choose Netscape. And then, at least according to findings in the court, Microsoft was very persuasive in making them choose Internet Explorer instead, despite the fact that AOL had bought Netscape and still chose not to put it under the hood. And why did it do it? Because it wanted to be inside the Internet connection wizard, and that was part of the price of entry. That was some of the bullying that was alleged to go on, which Judge Jackson found says finding the facts in fact did go on as part of the case. So the case continues to this day, as you know. Judge Jackson found against Microsoft, chose to say that they should be split up as a remedy. You had available my paper on remedy to suggest something quite different. Let me just run through the reasons to care, and then I'll get the question in the back. Market reasons. These are just the classic reasons to care that say, if you end up with a monopoly and it stays a monopoly, you end up with crappy products and high prices. Now, we don't necessarily see that. It's not clear that Windows is that bad a product, and it's not clear that the price of Windows is that high. It typically represents $60 or $70 of the money you pay for a $400 or $1,000 or $2,000. $2,000 computer. The other reason to care, and the one that bears on the trajectory of this course, the way to plug this node into everything else we've been talking about, is the ripples it can cause in the architecture of cyberspace. I'll convert leverage in a second. Let me spend that second time. Right here's our classic picture, and there in the right square is a point of presence on the internet running an operating system. And if in fact all of these sources and destinations are running the same operating system, it offers potentials for control. Think about the way in which the content advisor that you can enable with Internet Explorer can itself then be a monopoly, a filter for which if you get filtered out by the Internet Explorer content advisor, forget it, nobody's going to see you. It's a much more effective lever of control, private policy, than if there were a whole bunch of different filters and you get filtered by some and not by others. And even in fact, that means there's a path to government control should government want to assert it. Because they only have one arm to twist, the Microsoft arm. Say, Microsoft, you ought to do this. Here's a speed bump you need to incorporate into your software. And boom, that speed bump goes out everywhere. Then, again, you have a diverse marketplace of stuff going on. That's how this connects to sort of the technologies and politics of control. How might the internet be transformed into being quite different than it is today? Well, one answer is, if you've only got one kind of software replicated around, you may find it a lot easier to affect a change on everybody than if you've got a whole diversity of things going and you get a kind of inertia unto itself. Question at the back.
I don't understand why procedurally there was a totally new case under the ServerNet after the contempt.
Yeah.
Why did they go to Judge Jackson?
They just have a rule in the D.C. Circuit by which the chief judge assigns similar cases to judges who already built up some expertise on them. So it went to Judge Jackson, not randomly, but because it's a related case. But it's kind of fuzzy what's related and what's not in the D.C. Circuit rules. So that's a sort of reckless and from irritating description of the Microsoft case. I hope it was coherent in the 9 minutes we have. Again, I was kind of 2 hours except for yesterday, which I have under 60 minutes. And you know, there's a rotisserie question out a day early, and it asks of you to check out the ITIL site and take a look at the .biz proposals and come up with some criteria you want to use, and pretend that you're advising ICANN to figure out which .biz you want to choose. So you'll find those on the site. There is no class next Monday. There is no class next Monday. You can use the time to go in and tune in to the ICANN proceedings, but there is no class next Monday. That's payback for the extra session we did among the 19th of the court, et cetera. Any other announcements you can make before this round? So thank you all very much. No questions? Yeah.
I actually got a question that comes up on the early exit poll results.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Gore up by 6 in Florida, Bush up by 2 in Pennsylvania, Ashcroft is pulled ahead, Rob is trailing in Virginia, Gore is up by 3 in Michigan, Bush is leading in Ohio, Missouri, Wisconsin, Oregon, and West Virginia.
So
Tennessee and Arkansas.
For those of us